Here are the numbers now. The new one's just in. Wind from the west southwest at 3. Humidity 96%. It's 45 degrees. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg up next. Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTDHD. I'm Gregory Berg. In a moment, I'm going to introduce to you our very special guest for today's program, Michael Orban, a veteran of the Vietnam conflict and the author of a really important memoir about his experiences called Sold Out. Just a quick word about what is part of the morning show for the remainder of the week. Tomorrow, I speak with John Bacon, who co-authored with ESPN host John Saunders a really powerful memoir called Playing Hurt, My Journey from Despair to Hope. John Saunders was a highly regarded sportscaster on ESPN for many years. Sadly, he died shortly before this book was published, a memoir of his life and his courageous battle with depression, among other issues. Later in the week, we'll be speaking with James Schatzman from the Choral Arts Society. We'll be talking about the Racine Theater Guild's production of Indoor Outdoor, and on Friday, an interview with Rich Cohen, author of the Chicago Cubs' Story of a Curse. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.org. Over the last several weeks, in light of the telecast on PBS of the Ken Burns documentary series about the Vietnam War, I've been replaying a number of morning show interviews from the past, which have dealt in one way or another with the Vietnam conflict. I'm really privileged today on the morning show to be speaking with somebody who experienced this conflict very, very directly and personally as a soldier in Vietnam. His name, Michael Orban. He makes his home in West Bend and was kind enough to make the trip from his home to join us live in the studios to talk about the book that he wrote called Sold Out. And we should clarify, since you're just hearing the title, it's S-O-U-L-E-D, Sold Out, Conquering Combat PTSD, a memoir of war and inner peace, in which Michael S. Orban speaks very, very honestly and openly and actually with a very articulate voice about what he experienced in Vietnam and, in particular, what he experienced since then as someone who, like so many other soldiers in the Vietnam conflict, experienced a searing case of post-traumatic stress disorder at a time when that was not very widely understood at all. And finally receiving a diagnosis was a big part of helping him begin to heal from some that he had experienced. But there are other things that he experienced and other lessons that he learned that are also part of this this very interesting book. And before I forget, I want to make sure that I thank a loyal listener to WGTD's morning show, Harv Radke, who is the person who brought this book to my attention. And Harv, I thank you so much for bringing this book into my hands and for helping to make this interview possible. Michael Orban, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you very much, Greg. I'm really happy and excited to be here.
I suspect that you are experiencing what a lot of us are experiencing, but I'm curious to ask you about how this groundbreaking Ken Burns documentary series on PBS, I know you watched some of it, but not all of it by any means, but I suspect that you have experienced in a different way from the rest of us this sort of groundswell of new interest in Vietnam and new concerns about people who were part of that conflict. What kind of questions has this and conversations has the Ken Burns documentary series prompted as far as you're concerned directly?
The first one, I've only watched the first two series by Ken Burns, and I have a lot of respect for him. And I have to mention, one of the reasons I like watching Ken Burns is because a lot of us, and I'll speak for myself as a Vietnam veteran, learn not to trust politicians or trust anyone else. I trust Ken Burns to tell an honorable and honest story. When you invited me to be on the radio show, Greg, I decided not to watch any more of it so that any questions or opinions would be mine and not a reflection on what Ken Burns has written. But I did have a neighbor in particular who asked me, or actually made the statement, that during that time she was young, she had children, she was not paying attention to the war. But as she watched the Ken Burns series, she questioned me about the whole idea of McNamara and the generals lying to the Joint Chiefs of Staff and lying to the American people about what was actually happening in the war, what was the progress in the war. And I think that probably stands out as one of the most remarkable aspects of the war for me, what caused a lot of the anger issues. And I have to always border myself on being the infantry soldier who has the anger and the rage issues along with the intellectual civilized version of how we have to think about it. But that was probably the one so far that stands out the most.
Right. One of the things that worried me as someone who is not a veteran and not someone who came out of that conflict at all, although I mean I was a youngster at the time, but I can kind of remember things that were on television and so on, even when I was just at the tender age of 10 or 11 or 12. Still, it was something my parents talked about all the time, and we lived in a college town, so we had I maybe had a little more awareness of that reality than some did, but that's certainly not the same thing as actually living through it. But it led me to wonder if the airing of a series like this, even all these years later, might, at least for some Vietnam veterans, be stoking some of those really nightmarish memories and maybe bringing certain things to the surface in a way that would be sort of traumatic all over again. For you, has it been anything like that?
Not really in the sense of trauma. I'm actually happy that they're bringing it out so that we get a more clear picture of exactly what happened rather than the history that was written by McNamara and Westmoreland and the generals who participated. So I'm personally happy that it's coming out. I was able, by living in Africa for many years and meeting the Pygmies and remote tribes, I was happy to resolve a lot of my issues with the war. And, of course, after committing myself to the PTSD program in Tomah, Wisconsin, at the VA hospital, I was able to resolve or accept a lot of the experiences I had. Is it affecting veterans? Absolutely, I think it's going to. But retirement is actually affecting a lot of Vietnam veterans because they've been workaholics and they have spent all of their time focused on work or focused on issues other than the war so that they could not or would not be having these memories resurfacing. Mm. So we see a lot of Vietnam veterans coming forward as they retire because their mind is no longer occupied what the war will do, I think, will add to a lot of that. Hopefully in a way that is positive, and I would certainly like to reassure Vietnam veterans, if that is the issue, there is help available, and there are combat veterans available through the VA and through the vet centers to help with that. But I would certainly say that that's the case. And I think we could back that up, even though there's no information on it yet. A lot of Vietnam veterans struggled with 9/11. When that happened, a lot of the post-traumatic stress, there was a high number of Vietnam veterans who sought help after that event. So I'm pretty sure this will have the same effect.
Yeah. We're speaking with Michael S. Orban, a Vietnam veteran from West Bend, Wisconsin, and the author of a memoir about his experiences there and his years afterwards contending with the effects of post-traumatic stress disorder, his book called Sold Out, Combat PTSD, A Memoir of War and Inner Peace. Explain to our listeners, first of all, a little bit about who you were growing up. And was it in West Bend or close to West Bend?
Actually, Wauwatosa.
Wauwatosa.
Yeah, outside of Milwaukee.
What should we know about you ahead of heading off to Vietnam? What kind of a young person were you before the age of 18?
Well, I had a kind of chuckled, Greg, when you said that you were a young fellow at the time, because so were most of us.
Right.
I mean, I was drafted when I was 19. So I went. But my background was very strict Catholic, large family. I'm fourth, oldest of 10. So a very, very busy, healthy family at the time. It would become more destructive when my parents divorced. But at the time, fairly healthy. Played a lot of sports. I was really into restoring antique cars, riding motorcycles, playing baseball, and going to the bar on State Street on Saturday night to have a few beers after the softball games and all that sort of thing. My father was a World War II veteran who landed on Normandy Beach on D-Day, never spoke of it, but came home with his war chest filled with, he had a Hitler Youth knife, and he had survival knives from other armies, and a German officer's dress bayonet, all of these things, ashtrays from Cherbourg, France. And even though he never spoke of it, World War II always stood in the background from the stories I read, and especially with my interest in history. As just a very courageous battle that the American army or the American people fought to stop Hitler and to stop the Japanese and that sort of thing. My older brother had enlisted, and he was a paratrooper in the 82nd Airborne Division. But with 10 kids, we didn't have time to really pay attention to national, international news. We didn't have political discussions at dinner time. They were more who's going to clean the room, who's going to do the dishes, who, you know, that sort of thing, how's school. So I wasn't really aware of the issues in Vietnam. And the furthest I had been from home, understanding the geography, it was down to the Illinois border to buy margarine with my dad, because it was illegal to buy it in the States. So I hadn't been that far from home. So I was really more my commitment to the war, having been drafted, even though I had I was apprehensive about it, was this subliminal or background honor to my family. I couldn't disgrace my family. I mean, there were the issues of going to Canada. There were the issues of just going to prison. But I was not going to dishonor my family by doing that. So it was the pressure of my father being a World War II veteran, my brother being a paratrooper, that I just went along with the program and entered the military into the Army as a draftee in 1969.
So in other words, you had no serious reservations of in a sense answering the call of your country. I mean, that it made all the sense in the world, and you did not go into that experience with much in the way of trepidation or reservations, it doesn't sound like, aside from the obvious fears that any sensible person would have.
I'm glad you added that last phrase.
Right.
Sure, there were the fears, and you know, all the way along the line, you know, there was the expectation, well, maybe I'll be sent to Germany, maybe I'll be sent to someplace outside of a war zone. So there was that little bit of apprehension. But for the most part, no, I was going to go in and not heroically, but primarily not to, as I mentioned before, not to defame my family.
Right. You said something before we went on the air that I want you to talk about, and that's the fact that your deployment to Vietnam was dissimilar to what a lot of deployments would have been earlier in the conflict,
In
that your deployment was very much as an individual. You went into Vietnam, in a sense, very much alone.
Yeah.
Explain to our listeners what you're talking about
there
how and the significance of that. I mean, what difference that made in terms of what your experience was when you finally got to Vietnam.
Sure, I'd be happy to. And this would be, of course, just my expectations.
Right.
But going back, I was aware a little bit of the anti-war movement up in Madison, Wisconsin, because my girlfriend at the time had an uncle who was on the police force up there, and he had told stories how the anti-war movement was getting violent, and the police weren't familiar with those kind of tactics, you know, bricks hitting them and, you know, the violent reaction. But I had also been up there when late at night in August of 1970 when I heard an explosion. I was with my girlfriend saying goodbye to her before I went back to Milwaukee for work. And I heard the explosion that would turn out to be the bombing of Sterling Hall. So I was aware that there was an anti-war movement. But I had also, and this wasn't until many years later, had watched the History Channel on the Vietnam War and had seen Vietnam veterans who were interviewed who had gone through basic training, advanced infantry training, went on leave, and then were all sent to Vietnam together as a group of guys that had known each other from the day they entered the military. When I was, I went to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and then on to Fort Polk, Louisiana for advanced infantry training. And out of the entire battalion, I think we had one company that was selected to go to Vietnam. The rest were all going to Germany, which I have to admit, I was kind of hopeful that I wouldn't mind seeing Germany. But my company was the one selected to go to Vietnam, and not everybody in the company was selected. So I was given a 30-day leave to go home, which was a long leave. But then I went to Vietnam with one other person, arrived in Benoit, and then was and then went over to Long Bend, where I was assigned to the 1st Cavalry Division. And the person that had been in my advanced infantry company, he was assigned to the 101st Airborne up north. So as soon as I got to Vietnam, I was by myself. I mean, I was with the military, but as far as having somebody in my background that I had gone through any kind of training with, there was nobody there. And I reported in the jungle to a platoon of men that I had never met before in my life.
Yeah. And you just weren't expecting that was going to be...
No, I didn't expect that. And I think that, to this day, probably has a much bigger difference, in my opinion, of the war when I listened to the guys who really thought they were winning the war before President Johnson decided that he was going to jump ship. And when he jumped ship, unfortunately, the guys that are at war can't jump ship and go with him.
Right.
So there were many, many different opinions that I have that won't be parallel to what guys saw in 1965, 66,
right.
67.
It sounds from what you say in the book and in our brief discussion this morning that your let's maybe call them somewhat naive expectations about what you were going to experience there and the worth, or let's say the worthiness of our presence in Vietnam, that all of that was really seriously undermined, if not shattered, very early on. It's not that it took months.
No, it sounds
like it was really a matter of days before you realized that this was not at all what you thought it was going to be.
Absolutely, very soon. I would even say within the first week. Getting off the plane at the airport in Benoit, we had our new army fatigues on, and there was a line of soldiers who had already spent a year there who were preparing to get on the same plane that we arrived in to go home, and they just looked worn out, tired, angry, dead eyes going off. There was no patriotic, go get them, guys, we left you something, go fight the war, you know, get Ho Chi Minh. There was none of that. It was just quiet. Angry guys that were going in the opposite direction. It was almost frightful to see the expression on many, especially the infantry soldiers' eyes. But we knew immediately that, there was no cause. And this would come to be the understanding that I would have while I was there and ever since I've been home. If you don't believe in the mission and you're an infantry soldier, you're in big trouble, because you can be, as we did, have to take lives, especially civilians, knowing that there's no reason to do it.
Mm. And that makes, of course, the trauma of doing that all the more serious.
Yeah, it did, especially compared to the expectations, because there was this expectation that going to war, you're doing something. And as I mentioned earlier with you, Greg, World War II veterans always had this, we had to stop Hitler, we had to stop the Japanese. And I, while in Vietnam and certainly since, have never heard anyone say that we have to stop Ho Chi Minh. I never heard that. We have to stop communism. So our lives over there were really just who we were with, and survival was the only game. And the guilt and part of the trauma is also, I knew, or at least would come to understand when I unraveled it, that I was taking the lives of people who wanted to live as much as I wanted to live, but I was going to take their life because my life was more important, but without any reason that you could attach to war.
Sure. Right. I'm curious, you have already said that writing this book was therapeutic for you, and I can especially understand how sharing your experience of sort of surmounting the really hellish experience of post-traumatic stress disorder, I can understand how sharing about that, your long road of recovery, would be therapeutic. What about going back to what you experienced in Vietnam, including some really, really terrible experiences that you talk about? In any way, was that therapeutic to be thinking about those experiences and writing about them?
Absolutely. I would pick out two right off the top of my head, and one was my relationship with God and religion, organized religion. And I'm not in any way attempting to criticize the Catholic Church, but at the time, I'm a 19-year-old kid.
Right.
And on Easter Sunday, we had a Catholic priest and a Jewish rabbi and a Protestant minister come out into the jungle to say services on Easter Sunday, and I went to the Catholic service, and it never dawned on me until years later, I was going with a loaded machine gun to church. I mean, how many, and hand grenades, how many guys go to church? And if somebody had at that time told me, okay, make a choice, you can either go to church and leave the hand grenades and the rifle behind, or skip church and keep the rifle, I would have kept the rifle, because that's where we were. We were in survival. Religion was there, but the minister gave us a sermon in which he said that yesterday two of the American soldiers and the second of the seventh were killed. Now I want you to go out and get two of them. There was this shield, emotional shield, that dropped in front of me that negated religion, the Catholic Church, priests, God, everything. And now this was just purely war. Mm. And that took me a long time for somebody to convince me that, Mike, this man was not representing the entire Catholic Church.
Right, that's not what everybody believes.
It was his personal opinion. So I had to learn to forgive him. But killing, the other one was killing civilians by mistake in what other soldiers would recognize in elephant grass that was too high. We heard voices in Vietnamese open up in machine gun fire, which is very, very rapid. In less than 2 seconds, you can empty a clip of machine gun of ammunition, and to go on and find out that we had killed. Now, we're already in a war that I don't believe has a mission.
I'm not, right.
So it's even, you know, taking the lives of the Vietnamese soldiers was really catastrophic. But to do it to civilians, that took me a long, long time. How do you forgive yourself for killing somebody that is no longer alive to forgive you?
Hmm.
So, those things that I've had to go back and rectify, and I was able to do that. But it didn't come until many years later when I was, and I hope you don't mind me saying this, suicide had become a very close friend of mine, because I honestly believed, not because I was whiny and I can't take this anymore and life is difficult, I thought my mind was so destroyed that it would never recover. And that's when I committed myself to the post-traumatic stress clinic in Tomo, Wisconsin, and met the coordinator there, Deb Pergandy. And it was through there that I learned to write as therapy, but also to engage a lot of the reactions that I was having, the anger, the rage, the guilt, the shame, the nightmares, the panic attacks. All of these things were given to me on a sheet of paper. And when I could identify them, then I could resolve them or accept them as, this is just the reality of what happens. That was the most important thing to me.
Right. And so, in effect, then, the writing about some of these really terrible events or experiences in Vietnam was part of your, part of your therapy, a therapeutic exercise in coming to grips with this. You also talk about a really horrifying experience of something known as fragging. And I suspect that there's probably a few listeners that recognize that term, and many more that don't. Just say a word about the incident that I am talking about?
Well, it's not an incident. It was an occurrence. It was the rift between the non-commissioned officers, the younger guys, the Spec 4s, and officers that were out in the field, because a lot of times we would be sent out into the field, and the higher-ranking officers would remain in the rear or in some place where they could direct the battles or the activity from a relatively secure place. I had only seen this once in Vietnam when we were on a forward fire base, and we had just come out of the jungle. We were getting ready to go back out into the jungle the following day. So we were sitting in a small base that was really there to protect our artillery pits and the mortar pits, and had a command center and all under bunkers and a first aid station. So we were on the perimeter pulling guard duty for them, and then another company would come in and pull guard duty, and we'd go out for 15 days or so. And while we were there, we were sitting on the bunkers in the dark. I don't recall what time, but it was dark, nighttime, and I heard this huge explosion. And I could actually saw the flames shooting out of both ends of a small, they're like miniature Quonset huts that we were, semicircular sleeping positions that had sandbags on them. Well, it comes out, the story that I heard came out to be that the person that was in there had actually been killed by an officer. They had found the electric detonation wire from a Claymore mine coming out of this bunker and going back to a position. Nobody ever found out who did it, but the sky lit up with mortar illumination rounds, and helicopters were coming in and all this. And they finally, by the end of it, found out that this was just an internal explosion. But I didn't realize until I went to Toma and was talking about this, other people came up to me and explained and talked about fragging. One man had actually drawn the short straw to kill their company commander because he had refused to come down off of a hilltop with his platoon to help engage in the fight that they were in, and American soldiers were killed. So there was this activity that fragging means a fragmentation grenade. It's a grenade that you throw and it explodes into fragments. That's what killed. So there's the term fragging.
Right.
And so I haven't heard a lot of guys, but there are guys that I know, and myself included, who have witnessed that.
And, of course, even beyond the specific cases of fragging, including the one incident that you actually were, in a sense, a distant witness to, is just the fact that it represents, probably in the most serious sort of way, the general breakdown of discipline and morale that had been a hallmark of past conflicts, but just did not seem to be the case in Vietnam, at least in many places, and at least at this point in the conflict.
Well, I think, keeping in mind, as I mentioned before, up until President Johnson left office, before that, a lot of guys thought they were winning the war. They believed in the war. They believed in what was going on. When I was there in 1970, 71, that was completely gone. So anything that reflected, there was no belief in a mission. There was no mission to believe in. So he had all of these extemporaneous events happening. And as I spoke of earlier, General McCaffrey, Barry McCaffrey, who was a captain at the time, went over in 71 or 72, and listeners can look up the Barry McCaffrey report. He was there to give a report on the condition of the military, and he found it to be filled with low morale, drug addiction, racial problems, all of these things. And again, these are all the indicators of you've got an army that doesn't have a mission they believe in, or none of these things would be going on.
Right. We're speaking with Michael S. Orban, a Vietnam War veteran and the author of a memoir of his experiences called Sold Out, Conquering Combat PTSD, a Memoir of War and Inner Peace. When you come back to America, and you come back as quickly as you can, and you find yourself feeling terribly isolated from everybody around you, and no sense of connection, and no sense that anybody around you understands what you have experienced. And in the course of describing what it was like to return home, and how difficult that return was, you point out something that is so important to say, and that is the way we typically treat, for instance, a police officer when they are put in the unfortunate position of shooting someone and either injuring them or killing them or whatever, or someone else is involved in some kind of traumatic experience, and what they are offered in terms of special treatment and loving care, and none of that was offered to any of you at the time. It was just blithely assumed that you would be able to step away from these horrific experiences and not need any of the kind of special treatment that we now take for granted.
Yeah, it's actually stunning thinking. It's incredible thinking to think that 19-year-olds can go through all of this and then just come home and repair themselves and get on with life, as many people would tell us. When I remember coming home from Vietnam, I remember the day before I left Vietnam to come home from Benoit Airfield, and thinking to myself that I'm going home to life as exactly as it had been before the war. I'm going home to my wife, I'm going home to restoring cars, all the things that were fun for me before, my old friends. I had not realized that as an infantry soldier, I had emotionally shut down. I mean, I don't have a built-in psychiatrist that's telling me, you know, you're not feeling emotions. You know, to get through all of this war and the insanity and barbarism, you have emotionally shut down. So I couldn't understand when I came home, and I had no interest in any of the things that, or any of the people that had been of interest for me before. And one of the issues that I had a lot of rage with, now I went into nightmares and panic attacks and drinking and isolation, and really when you come back to it, a lot of this is retrospective thinking. I didn't know who I was anymore, because all of those things that I had learned as a value system when I grew up had been destroyed at war. You know, be kind to others, respect your elders, you know, all gone. Belief in God, all gone. So who am I? Mm. You know, and when your reality's gone, you don't stop and think, you know, my reality's gone, I think I'll just develop a new one. Well, you don't. You don't know who you are.
Or reach out for help.
And yeah, or reach out for help.
In fact, you don't even understand what's happened.
Sure.
I thought it was especially interesting, and it's a very basic thing to say, and yet I don't remember reading this in other memoirs in so many words. You say more than once that the things that had once given you pleasure gave you no pleasure at all. It's like those pathways, those neurological or emotional pathways, had just all been cut.
Yes.
And I was just trying to imagine what that would feel like. I don't know what those, even what we're talking about, but you know, if you used to love to fish,
yes,
or if you used to love to play the piano or whatever, and then come back from a traumatic experience and suddenly these sources of pleasure meant nothing to you.
Absolutely nothing. In fact, I try to use the description that my mind felt like a computer that had been overloaded, could not absorb any more information, but couldn't process what it had already taken in. So when I came home, it was even that bad that I was so internalized psychologically and spiritually that I didn't see colors. I didn't, you know, that, like now when you drive along the expressway, sometimes you'll see the beautiful beds of endless purple flowers or the birds. I didn't see any of that anymore. Nothing gave me pleasure.
And I know that one of the most painful things about your experience is the wedge that was driven between you and your wife. Mm. And this is, of course, a very common experience. But the fact that you had both experienced terrible trauma.
Yes.
And somehow each did not fully understand and appreciate the trauma of the other. Mm. And that just in and of itself was enough to ultimately drive the marriage irreparably apart.
Yeah, notwithstanding anything that my wife would have done at the time when I came home, there's no way that marriage would ever have survived just based on who I was. It couldn't have, because I couldn't survive on my own myself. My own myself is redundant, but no, yeah. I could not take care of myself. There's no way that a human being could have been asked or should have been asked to understand who I was or try to live with me under those conditions. So I, even though, yes, the marriage did fail, and yes, there were things that my wife did that, you know, I will never ever go back and put the blame there. It would be on me not knowing myself and being way beyond able to take any responsibility for what was going on.
You did go to college, and it's interesting, at one point as you're describing this, you said, so I decided to run. And I remember thinking, oh, that was a good idea, to run. I mean, as in physically run, like go out for cross country or something, and you didn't mean that running.
No,
like
I didn't
that
mean jogging.
You meant running from this reality. But you end up at college, and my eyes lit up that out of everything you experienced there, which was very little in the way of deep satisfaction or anything meaningful, you just weren't in a position. one of the only classes that really was a bright spot for you was a class in which you studied classical music, and for the first time in your life, you experienced the music of Mozart. And it's so interesting to think about the music of Mozart penetrating what otherwise was this thick shield that you had, in a sense, erected around yourself.
It's really true. And at the time, music to me was all of the drum beat and the dark anti-war music and Tin Soldiers and Nixon's Coming, all of those things. And that was depressing to me. So music of my generation did nothing for me. And I actually was studying engineering, and my goal, the GI Bill was there. And you know, to go to college, which I never would have had a really strong opportunity coming from the family that I was brought up in, this was a wonderful opportunity. But yet I was failing because, again, I couldn't focus. I couldn't absorb more information. I was angry. How could these people be going to school and loving what they're doing and having goals and dreams when they don't understand what we've done to human beings and what we are as human beings? So I was in a completely different frame of mind. And I actually took the history of symphony just as an easy course to get through all the mathematics and physics. Turned out to be one of the toughest courses I ever took because we had to be able to identify musicians and composers. And I listened to Mozart, and there was no music in it. It was just beauty. If you could detach and drift, especially with the violins, which today are still my favorite music, and I could just listen to it. And it could, and I think I wrote this in a book, it could be anything I wanted it to be. It didn't have to be hating Nixon. It didn't have to be, you know, hating anything or anti anything. So, yeah, to this day, classical music and yoga are probably two of the things that I've learned to help deal with some of these things. Yeah. Mm.
Well, the other thing that ended up being a very, very powerful road out of this dark place was the experience of joining the Peace Corps.
Yes.
And your ultimate choice was to go to Africa, of all places. And some people would probably be amazed that out of this thick catalog of all the different places you could go all around the world, that you didn't choose a place like Finland or Hawaii. Some place where that would have borne no resemblance whatsoever to the jungles of Vietnam, and yet something drew you to Africa, and ultimately that was quite a positive experience. And I have to say, that's one of the biggest surprises in your wonderful book, because as we're turning the pages and you are setting off for Africa, given what you've described about your mental and emotional state, I just couldn't imagine that experience in the Peace Corps was going to ultimately be such a positive one for you. Not that it didn't have certain difficulties and painful moments, but by and large, it was an extraordinarily positive and important experience for you.
As it was. Actually, I always say that Africa, the Pygmies, and Albert Schweitzer saved my life.
Right.
At that time. But I had grown up as a young boy loving National Geographic, and I don't for the listeners who remember the Washington Park Zoo before it became the big zoo out on Blue Mound Road, the animals lived in these cages, and they were, I always felt sorry for them, and so I had a goal of a desire or dream to be an explorer or a photographer for National Geographic. Well, the military decided they'd send me to the other side of the world, but for other reasons. But going to Vietnam made my world a lot smaller. And so when I had difficulties, and I didn't want to embarrass my family who had been through these other conflicts, had soldiers in other conflicts, and I was embarrassing them with my inability to finish school or stay focused in school and failing at school. So when I saw the big brochure in the window of the continent of Africa, what I had seen when I was in Africa, when I was reading the National Geographic books, I would see the Maasai warriors, and I would see the Zulus, and I would see all of the Pygmies, and just the animals in the spectacle of living in the Serengeti. So this seemed to me, when I saw the brochure for the Peace Corps, would do two things for me. It would make me look good to my family and the world because I was joining the Peace Corps and going to do something good, but it would also get me away from the emotional and psychological torment of failing at home. But it would take me to this place that I'd always wanted to see. And Africa, the jungles, had no fear for me at all after Vietnam.
And you say two things. You say living there remains one of the most intense learning experiences of your life.
Sure.
And you said the bush was the home you were looking for?
I would extend it a little bit further and say when I first met the Pygmies, and I'm not being arrogant by saying this, but very few people have met the Pygmies in their home territory. And I was taken in there, and I had to be there quite a while in Gabon, West Africa, before I was allowed or invited to meet the Pygmies. So when I did see the first two families and they appeared in the jungle, they had these broad smiles on their face, very welcoming smiles. And yes, they were barefoot and in rags, for, you know, loincloth. And yes, they were tiny little people. But as they were introduced to me, they explained that, you know, you would see these people in barefoot and in no homes and nomadic forest livers. And you would think to yourself that these are really impoverished people, both physically, medically, and all of that sort of thing. And they explained their life to me. They said that the jungle gave them medicine. It gave them food. It gave them shelter. It gave them everything that they needed was provided by the jungle. And they said their only obligation in life was to take care of their god, the jungle. And I thought to myself, well, this is the most plausible religion I've ever come up against. But it had a much more profound effect on me in the sense that being in post-traumatic stress, so internalized that it was about me, it was my anger, the war wasn't what I wanted it to be, the generals weren't what I wanted them to be, politicians weren't, you know, so I could go through this whole, I'll just engage my own internalization of war, life not being what I wanted it to be, and I was the judge and I was the jury and all of this, and here were this group of pygmies explaining to me how they were connected to something much bigger than themselves. So it was the pygmies who actually showed me, I'll put it in my language, what they were saying, this ain't about you. It's about you belonging to something better. You want to take care of it or do you want to make it worse, psychologically and spiritually? That was a big, big change, a fence for me to cross.
Right, of course, because most people caught either in depression or in the wake of a terrible trauma or both, that's one of the first things that tends to be lost is any sense of others. You are just consumed by your own pain and what you believe.
Disconnected.
Yeah, absolutely.
Disconnected and isolated.
Right. You, of course, eventually return home, and although your issues are not completely resolved, but you are on the path to some recovery. But, of course, it makes a gigantic difference in the early 1990s when finally you are given a diagnosis that you are someone suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. What kind of difference did it make simply to have it be given a name and, in a sense, for you to understand maybe a little more clearly what had happened to you? Did that in and of itself make a huge difference?
The name, still, I'm very much in conflict with the name. So coming up with the name didn't impress me. But the public recognition of the condition of this had a huge effect, that it was acceptable. But it also allowed me to explore it more and to understand, again, when I'm isolated, I don't think any other soldier has this. So I'm thinking to myself, how I can't say that I have these issues because then I've failed as a man and I failed my obligations as a soldier to my country. To have this come out and be more broadly spoken about and recognized was huge for me. But at the same time, when I first returned from Vietnam, because of today I guess they would call it a traumatic brain injury from an artillery, I was caught in an artillery barrage, had massive, terrible headaches. So I was actually getting or receiving counseling at the VA hospital in 1972, but was never, ever, and this is at the VA hospital, and believe me, I'm a firm backer of the VA hospitals, but at this time, 1972, when I was speaking with a counselor, I was never asked about my experiences at war. So even the VA wasn't really addressing it that directly at the time. So when they did start opening it up and speaking about it, it was a great relief. But then carrying that forward, after meeting Albert Schweitzer in Africa, and he had won the Nobel Peace Prize for his speaking, A Reverence for Life and The Will to Live, I was studying all these things. When I eventually realized that I needed treatment and went up to the post-traumatic stress clinic at Tomo, the VA hospital in Tomo, Wisconsin, and they, within 15 minutes, gave me a sheet of paper with 21 common responses to trauma, And I read through all 21 of these. Now, I would not have received this in 1972 because they weren't addressing it.
Right.
This here was the change. And I went through the list, and all 21 of them I could identify and check off as having some reaction to each one of these, which would be rage, the guilt, the shame, the isolation, the nightmares, the survivor guilt, all of these different things. And I was furious when I read this, but I wasn't furious that they were giving it to me. I was furious, going back to your question from before, Greg, I was furious they hadn't given me this the day I got out of the service, because it was identifying everything that I was really entangled in, because my mind would go from the anger of my friend who I had known all of my life. We were in Vietnam together, in different companies, but at the same time, came home and he killed himself. I was at anger about that. Then I'd go to crying because of the pain he went through. Then, so my mind could never stop on one reaction, because it would keep going from the anger to the rage to the guilt of the people that we had killed by mistake to the shame of what human beings, all of these things. This helped me to bring them out individually and say, what is not, okay, I know I have rage, but what is the rage? When I could identify the rage, then I could resolve it.
Right.
What is the guilt? Well, I'm suffering from it. Well, the guilt is that we killed these people. Okay, now I can resolve that or accept it. And that's when the writing came in of, to get this out of my head, I'd have to write it down just to keep track of it.
Yeah, to just kind of sort out all these powerful, potent emotions that were kind of barraging you. And I remember at one point in your book, you say this more than once, that one of the greatest fears that most people have is the fear of losing their mind. Yeah. And I think that takes a lot of shapes. I think a lot of us fear someday that we will suffer from dementia. I think some of us, for whatever reason, if we have mental illness in our family, might have a deep down fear that someday that might be something that we ourselves have to confront or experience. And I think about how terrifying it would be to come home from a conflict like Vietnam and have the very real fear that you are mentally and emotionally hanging on by a thread, and with this thick facade in which you find yourself unable to reach out for help. You have no idea if there's even help out there, or if anyone else in the world has ever experienced what you have. And of course, now you're at a place where you know the answer to those questions.
Yes.
In the last minute or so that we have, say a word about the means by which you try to share your story and particularly reach out to your fellow veterans.
Well, I'm part of a program at the Medical College of Wisconsin up in Wauwatosa, and they've been very good at reaching out and promoting the work that we do with veterans. We have the Warrior Partnership there where we as combat veterans go in and help future doctors and medical students better understand how to be in the company of veterans, how to communicate with them, and we're in our seventh year there. So that's been very effective. And the medical college has been very, very good at helping veterans and promoting veterans' health issues. I also do work with David Carlson, who is a combat veteran with two tours in Iraq, to help to work with the veterans who are incarcerated, because these guys are once they're incarcerated, they receive no benefits, no help, no mental health treatment at all. I also am part of a team that will go in and help with continuing education for prison guards, so they better understand the veterans who are in prison. But wherever we have opportunities to speak to groups, I'm always available to speak on the topic. Primarily in promoting the sense that, yes, we come home from war troubled, but the fear of suicide as a means out, we can do something, and there are those of us who have experienced that and can help. So that's primarily where I go to do the work, through the medical college, through the prisons, and through public speaking.
Right. I know that you are just back from a trip, an honor flight trip to the Washington, D.C. Area, and saw the Vietnam Memorial, saw all those names, and you were told that of all those many names, thousands and thousands of names on that Vietnam Memorial, that the largest single group in terms of age are 18-year-olds who lost their life in Vietnam.
Yeah, they are. And if I could just say very, very quickly, that the honor flight is probably one of the most healing experiences I've had. Not for myself as a combat veteran, but for my family. And what these people have put together, I would encourage any veteran of any MOS who's a Vietnam veteran to sign up for the honor flight, because it's very, very healing. And think of your families who need to heal too, because they'll get a good healing from it.
Very good. Again, the title of your book is Sold Out, Conquering Combat PTSD, a Memoir of War and Inner Peace. Again, the word sold is S-O-U-L-E-D. So if you type that into Amazon or go looking for it at Barnes & Noble or wherever.
What's on my website.
Yes, and your website, what's that address?
Would be my name, Michael Orban, M-I-C-H-A-E-L-O-R-B-A-N, .com.
Very
and
good.
And my book is available, plus the list of traumatic common responses to trauma is there as well.
And some resources at the back. Yeah. Michael Orban, I'm so glad we had this conversation. I thank you so much for telling your story so very well in your very fine